We turn again this morning in the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 11, reading from verse 20 to 22. The letter to the Hebrews was written to men and women who had come to believe in Jesus as the Messiah sent by God to be the Savior of the world. They had begun to suffer for their faith in Jesus Christ. And this letter was written to encourage them to go on. It was written by a pastor who seeks, first of all, to lift up Jesus Christ and to show them that he is the preeminent one. And secondly, he writes to warn them of the tragedy that would await them if they turned back from Jesus Christ. And in chapter 11, he sets before them the heroes of the faith, the heroes who dominate the Old Testament landscape, and he seeks through their example of faith to inspire these hard-pressed Hebrew Christians to stand firm and to go on with Christ. So in verse 18, we read, if I can maybe put my glasses on, it would help. My apologies, my eyes get worse and worse, and I keep delaying wearing glasses, but necessity requires it. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. These three verses, 20 through 22, and these three names that are at the heart of these three verses, cover 29 dramatic chapters in the book of Genesis. And throughout those 29 deeply dramatic chapters, we see God in the midst of human deceit, in the midst of family tragedy, in the midst of unimaginable immorality, pursuing his purpose to send a Savior who would crush Satan and bring salvation and hope to a fallen world. Whenever you're reading the Bible, and wherever you are reading in the Bible, you will always find it helpful to have Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, in the very forefront of your mind. Genesis 3:15 perhaps is the most significant text in the whole of the Bible. Indeed, the whole of the Bible is really an unfolding exposition of Genesis 3:15, where God says in the midst of the wreckage of Adam's sin that he will raise up someone from the seed of woman who will crush the head of the serpent. The serpent will strike at his heel, but he will crush the head of the serpent. And the whole of the Bible from this point on is both an anticipation of that promise and an unfolding exposition of how God would go about bringing that promise to fulfillment. Now, the writer to the Hebrews could have highlighted any number of significant events in the lives of Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph that would have served his purpose to illustrate the importance, the vital importance of trusting God, Not just when times were good, but especially when times are hard and bad. He could have chosen any number of examples and incidents to make that point. But he chooses in verses 20 to 22 to focus on the one feature that united these three very, very different men, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And the one thing that united these three very, very different men was this, that when they died trusting in the God who had promised them a future. That's the one thing that the writer, I think, wants to convey by mentioning Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. He wants to show these Hebrew Christians that these stellar individuals in the life history of the Jewish people were men who, when they died, died trusting in the God who had promised them a future. The approach of death did not kill the faith of these men. They died as they had lived, trusting God. But remember, and if you don't know the book of Genesis, take my word for it. These three men, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, were not paragons. They were men who failed badly, each of them. They were men who knew what it was to fail God badly. Jacob is called the deceiver, the supplanter. Isaac is portrayed, I think, as a kind of weak man under the shadow of his wife. And Joseph exhibited pride. It's not that these men were perfect saints. They were men who had failed, who had fallen, but when they died trusting the God who had promised. Let me look briefly with you at these three men. We're told, first of all, that as death drew near, Isaac showed his trust in God's promise by invoking future blessings on Jacob and Esau. That's all the New Testament really has to say about Isaac. When he was dying, he invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. Now, we could spend some time, interestingly and hopefully profitably, thinking about how it was that Isaac blessed Jacob when actually he thought he was blessing Esau. Because Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph all illustrate another wonderful aspect of God's salvation history. That salvation is God's sovereign prerogative. Isaac was not Abraham's firstborn, but the promise of God focused on Isaac, not Ishmael. Jacob was not Isaac's firstborn, it was Esau. But God's salvation promise focused on Jacob and not Esau. And the two sons of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, Manasseh was the elder, but God's promise of salvation focused on Ephraim, the younger. But that I don't think, maybe you can correct me later, I don't think that really is in the mind here of the writer, because he is laser visioned in the one thing he wants to get over to these hard pressed, sorely suffering Hebrew Christians. When Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph died, they died trusting in the God who promised them a future. God had said to Abraham, "In you, Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed." from you will come forth a deliverer. And so Isaac, when he was dying, he pronounces this blessing, thinking it's on Esau, but actually, in the mercy and sovereignty of God, it's on Jacob. We don't need to go into that. It's a blessing God has designed for Jacob. Let people serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you. And the key word that the writer to the Hebrews wants to press home to us is that by faith Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and on Esau. There were blessings for Esau, but they were merely earthly. They were material. They were not the rich blessings of a covenant heritage, of a covenant future, of God's salvation promise running through the line of Abraham, through Jacob and down through history. That was not the privilege given to Esau. What Isaac is saying here in his invoking future blessings is that Jacob was to be the guarantee of Isaac's own future. God had promised that he would raise up one from the seed of woman who would crush the serpent's head. And that promise was to run like a golden thread through human history in the line of God's covenant people. And Abraham passed on to Isaac, and Isaac to Jacob. And Jacob, as he lived out his life and handed on the covenant promises of God, Jacob was the guarantee of Isaac's own future. And the simple point, I think, the writer wants to leave with these Hebrew Christians is this. When Isaac, great Isaac, the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, when Isaac died, he had not received the fullness of God's promise. It was still far off. It was a dim and a distant hope, but he died trusting the God who had promised. You see, Hebrews 11 is not really about faith. So that we end up thinking, is my faith good enough, strong enough, stable enough? Hebrews 11 is not really about faith. It's about God. A God who can be trusted. In a sense, I'll put it as bluntly as I can and maybe retract a little. The quality of your faith is of little moment. It's not your faith that will bring you to glory. It is God in whom your faith resides who will bring you to glory. Though your faith be weak and feeble and frail and halting and lacking, if it be in this God of saving covenant promise, it will bring you to glory because it's God who does the bringing. And what the writer is saying is not, have faith. Well, he is saying have faith, of course he is. But he's saying have faith in God. He can be trusted. Depend upon it. He is not a man that he should lie. Then in verse 21, we're told, by faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. Now, scholars have written screeds and screeds and screeds about this. But the important thing, and in a sense, the only thing the writer wants us to notice is that as death drew near, Jacob bowed in worship, humbly submitting to God's will, confessing God's goodness. That's what I think bowing in worship over the head of his staff is all about, and affirming his trust in God's promise to bless the nations through the line of covenant promise. Now, he blesses Ephraim, the younger son, and not Manasseh, the older son. He crosses his arms, Genesis 48 and 49. And Joseph is really angry. He's saying, no, the blessing should go to Manasseh. And Jacob says, the blessing is going to the one to whom God says the blessing is to go. But that, if you like, is the minor note, I think. The major note is, and Genesis 48 verse 19 brings this out very, very strongly. The important thing is that as Jacob lay dying, he understood that God's blessing, his promise to bring ultimate salvation to a fallen world, was continuing through the line of Ephraim. As death drew near, what did Jacob do? What did Jacob do? He blessed each of the sons of Joseph. Now, if we had time, we don't have time really, we could look at Genesis 48 and we could see that the rich blessing, the covenant blessing, the blessing that would ultimately come to fulfillment in the birth of Jesus Christ the Savior, comes through the line of Ephraim. But the significant thing is that he blessed prophetically. He prophetically blessed. Now, how did Jacob know what to say to each of these sons? Well, I can only conjecture, because God had revealed that to him. And what Jacob is saying is, as I breathe my last, I want my family to know that my confidence is in the God who promises. I want my family to know that as I die, I do not die forlorn, without hope. God's promise has not yet materialized. But one day it will. And I'm going to bless, as God has called me to bless, these sons. And I want you to know that as I die in the faith of the God who promises and who will one day fulfill his promise. And then there is Joseph. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. You'll remember, Joseph goes down to Egypt. Life is hard for him, but then God wonderfully turns things around and Joseph is elevated to the second in Egypt, only after Pharaoh. And eventually, Jacob, his father, and all the other members of the family come down because of the famine, and Joseph realizes that he has been sent ahead to prepare the way for them and to provide for them. And they settle down in Egypt. But when Joseph was dying, he made mention of the exodus, the return, the going out, and gave direction concerning his bones. Now, what on earth is all that about? Well, the exodus would be many, many years in the future. It's difficult to say, but perhaps another 200 years or so, more than that, after Joseph died. But Joseph knew that God had made a promise to give his people a land that would typify and symbolize something grander and ultimately more glorious. Joseph knew that Egypt was not his terminus ad quem, his final resting place. And he was so certain that God would live up to his promise, he gave directions concerning his bones. Make sure that nothing of my earthly existence remains in this place, because God has promised us a future somewhere else. Joseph was telling his family that Egypt would not be their home forever. It's a remarkable thing that prosperity and power and status and influence had not dimmed the flame of Joseph's faith. I wonder if your children and my children know that our great hope does not lie this side of the grave. I wonder if our lives say to our children, this world is not my home. What was the united testimony of these three men as death reached out to claim them? Simply this. And maybe I've got this all wrong, and you better scholars can tell me. What was the united testimony of these three men as death reached out to claim them? Simply this. God is faithful and will fulfill all his promises to his people. Bank on it, trust in it, in the midst of persecution, rely upon it. Look back to verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar. God has made a promise that Jesus Christ will return. One of the children said that. We don't know when that promise will be fulfilled, but we greet it from afar. Why? Because faith penetrates the seen to the unseen. Faith tastes the promises of God and tastes them as good. God's promises are not mere words. They are rich food that we can taste. And we look forward to the coming again of our Savior Jesus Christ. We may die not having seen that coming, but we see it from afar and we greet it from afar. Now, these old covenant believers did not have the fullness of biblical truth that we possess today. We have the climactic revelation of God's love and faithfulness in the coming, living, dying, and rising of our Savior Jesus Christ. We live this side of the cross. They looked forward dimly through promise to what was coming. We have seen, as God has recorded it for us in his word, we have seen, as it were, the fulfillment of that promise. They lived in the age of promise. We live in the age of fulfillment, or nearly the age of fulfillment. Because the fulfillment in which we live is still to be fully consummated. So we are called to live by faith. God promises us one day resurrection bodies. That's an amazing promise. We look at these worn out, increasingly decrepit bodies. We suffer illness and pain, and sometimes people we love just wither away before our eyes, and circumstances seem to mock the promises of God. He promises us a new heavens and a new earth. No more tears. And we have to live by faith, trusting that the God who promises this will surely bring this to pass. You see, the examples of Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and I close with this, impress this upon us, and we need all of us to take this to heart, that saving faith, the faith that unites us to Jesus Christ, the faith that pleases God, the faith that will bring us to heaven's glory, is a living and a present faith. What I mean is this. A Christian's testimony is not 40 years ago, I put my trust in Jesus Christ. Now that's good. That's good. A Christian's testimony is, by the grace of God, as I breathe this breath, my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. That's my standing before God. That's my testimony. Not 40, 30, 25, last week I trusted Christ and became a Christian. Well, that's good to know. But that is only as good as this, that as you breathe this breath, you are saying, Jesus Christ is my only hope. It's a great thing to be found living by faith when you die. I'm not sure there is anything else that more ultimately matters than that. That you leave this life trusting in Jesus Christ, in the God who has promised that those who trust in his Son pass from death into life, and will be brought into the glory of his eternal presence. You see, in the final analysis, and this I think is what the writer is saying all the way through this chapter, can God be trusted? Are his promises reliable? And the writer is saying, Isaac believed it. Jacob believed it. Joseph believed it. Are you struggling with your Christian faith this morning? Do your circumstances seem to shout out either that God doesn't care or that he's gone walkabout? The question you need to ask yourself is this. In spite of my difficult circumstances, can I trust the God of covenant faithfulness? These old covenant saints anchored their trust and confidence in the promise of God to send them a deliverer. And it's no different for us. We anchor our hope before God in his promise that by the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ, our sin is fully and forever dealt with. We're adopted into his family and will one day be seated with him on the throne of his glory. Two little words, by faith. What will your epitaph read? I'm sure I've told you this before, but I'm at that interesting age where you repeat yourself repeatedly. But when my children were younger, they came to me en masse. I've got four children. And I'm sure it was David said, Dad, we've decided what to write on your headstone when you die. I thought, well, that's a very unusual thing for children to be thinking about. So I thought, well, what are you going to write? Thinking, well, you know, wonderful father, loving husband, faithful preacher. No, and he was not brief, was what they were going to write. Well, that's probably true. But oh, I hope they preface it with this. By faith, he was not brief. By faith. And if you understand your prepositions, and I hope they do, the accent is not on the faith, but in the direct object of faith, the Son of God, Jesus Christ. What will your epitaph read? What will they say about you in the times if you ever reach such dizzying heights when you die? Please God, it will be this, if nothing else. She lived by faith in Jesus Christ, and she died in the faith of Jesus Christ. What an epitaph that would be.